Okay, well, we left off in Mark last at the triumphal entry on Palm Sunday. We paused last week to look back at Psalm 22 on Easter. And now today we resume back in Mark. So, in today we're going to look at verses 12 through 25. We're going to see the story that kind of happens here. And we're also going to talk about something that Mark's been doing throughout his gospel and will keep doing. And we're going to use today to kind of explain it, and it'll help us understand how Mark writes a little bit better. So previously, like we said, we had been coming into Jerusalem, and then at the end of the night on Sunday night, we went back to Bethany where we're staying over kind of the course of this week. We'll keep seeing that. They come into town, then they withdraw to Bethany right outside of town. And so now it's Tuesday morning, and we're headed in. I'm going to read verses 12 through 25, and then we'll go from there. So Mark chapter 11, verse 12. On the following day, when they came from Bethany, he was hungry. And seeing in the distance a fig tree and leaf, he went to see if he could find anything on it. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. And he said to it, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And the disciples heard it. And they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold and those who bought the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And he was teaching them and saying to them, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations'? But you have made it a den of robbers." And the chief priests and the scribes heard it and were seeking a way to destroy him. For they feared him, because all the crowd was astonished at his teaching. And when evening came, they went out of the city. As they passed by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. And Peter remembered and said to him, "Rabbi, look, the fig tree that you cursed has withered." And Jesus answered them, "Have faith in God. Truly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, 'Be taken up and thrown into the sea,' and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says will come to pass, it will be done for him. Therefore, I tell you, whatever you ask in prayer, believe that you have received it, and it will be yours. And whenever you stand praying, forgive if you have anything against anyone, so that your Father, who is also in heaven, may forgive you for your trespasses." Okay, let's head on back up to verse 12, and we'll start right there. So like we said, it's now Monday. Sunday had passed. They had that whole entry. Jesus went to the temple, saw it and observed it, and then he went back to Bethany. And what we had talked about was that journey from Bethany on into Jerusalem encounters the Mount of Olives. And then that last 200 yards from the Mount of Olives into the gates of the city, where the temple is sitting right there on that east side of the city. So when Jesus is walking here, they came from Bethany and they're headed to Jerusalem. Notice in verse 15 is when they get there to Jerusalem. So right now we're not in the city yet. And he curses this fig tree. Now, but notice though, he sees it in leaf in the distance. I don't know about you. Me personally, don't have a lot of fig trees in my life. It's not exactly native here. However, or home in Tennessee. However, fig trees are everywhere. In Jerusalem, everywhere in that area. Very, very common plant. And so, in fact, we could use, for example, John 1, the calling of the apostle Nathanael. What happens? He was sitting under a tree when he has a vision from God, under a fig tree. And that's when Jesus calls him. So we can just use other little moments to point out this isn't like the one fig tree in the area. This is a very common plant. It also says this: he sees a fig tree in leaf. But then Mark goes on to explain, because remember, like we've talked about with Mark, he's writing to the Gentiles, almost certainly in Rome, also people who don't have fig trees everywhere. So he's explaining something to them. When the fig tree is in leaf, it is not yet the season for full figs. The fig tree leafs about right now, actually a little earlier than right now, early April, late March is when it leafs. Full figs are developed by early June. However, if you're like me and you didn't grow up around figs, when you read this, you might first think, oh, okay, so there should only be leaves on the fig tree right now. But that's not actually the case. There's something called a taksh, or you could just call it a knob, is another way that you could look at it. If you looked up fig knobs, you would find what we're talking about, this taksh. And what that is it's this little pre-fruit that starts to grow. It's the beginning of the fig. It has not fully bloomed into a fig, but it's there and it's edible. You can eat it. And here's the thing about the taksh. It's the sign whether it will bear fruit or not. If a fig tree is in leaf but it has no taksh, no figs are coming. It is still alive, it's still blooming leaves, but it is no longer bearing fruit. So when Jesus comes up to this thing and he sees nothing but leaves, what he knows is there should be taksh because the taksh comes before the fig leaves. That's the first thing that buds is these little knobs. Then the leaves and then those knobs become a full fruit. So when he approaches this tree and he sees leaves from afar, the assumption would be if this is a good fruitful tree, there will be these edible little taksh, these little knobs that we could pick off. They look almost like, well, green version of like crab apples. And I had crab apple trees everywhere. I could pick those and they were edible. They were a little sour, but you could chew on those. And so that's what Jesus is looking for and what he doesn't find. This is also just one more thing to note. This is also the only destructive miracle in Scripture. It's the only time we see Jesus destroy something. He prophesies about the temple and things like that. But as far as him actually using miracle power, this is the only time that he destroys something. Now, all this right now might feel a little confusing. But like what we said was, hey, we want to talk today about something Mark does in his writing. And it helps us understand. Because right now, all we've done is we've read these couple verses. Three verses. They're walking from Bethany. Jesus is hungry. He sees the tree that should have some of these little knobs, and they don't. And so he says, "May no one ever eat fruit of you again." And his disciples heard it. So for us reading this, and really for his disciples too, there's a level of, okay, why? What? Jesus, surely this isn't like the only tree that has had no fruit. Jesus, surely this isn't the only time that you're hungry and that you were looking for something and maybe the first thing that you went to didn't have quite what you're looking for. Like, oh, the apple's here. Oh, that one's bruised. How about that one? So why do we tell this story? Well, here's what Mark does. We've already seen some examples of this. For example, back in chapter 5, we had where Jairus' father came to him and said, hey, come and heal my daughter. And then in the middle of that story, we had the woman who touched him. And then we resumed back with Jairus' daughter. Or we could look at when Jesus was first sending out the apostles as the apostles. They get brought out to this great call. And then we see the story of John the Baptist being executed. And then it resumes with the disciples on their sending out for that very first time. What Mark does a lot, it's called a Mark sandwich. He has a story and he puts something right in the middle. And what's happening right in the middle, it usually is in the timeline, but he chooses to tell this story because it helps us understand what's happening in the sandwich. That middle part is interpretive for us. We're supposed to bring this all together. Let's use the example of Jairus and his daughter and then the woman who touches him. We have this first beginning of the story where a man comes to Jesus and says, hey, please come and heal my daughter. I need this help. And Jesus agrees. And so we have the setup of the story. And there's almost this shocking thing. But then, even though it's in the narrative of him moving, we pause away. We don't just say, oh, okay, I'm going to heal his daughter. And then we say, and he journeyed on through. And then he got there and he healed her. We pause. We interrupt the middle of that. And it helps us understand where we have this moment where the woman comes up and touches him. And he talks about this great faith. That merely just this great faith in this moment is what would heal. And then what happens? We resume back with Jairus' daughter. And with great faith, an even greater healing happens. Not only is a 12-year-long bleeding stopped, but now someone is brought from death to life, all on the principle of faith. So Mark does this. He does this. People propose up to 20 times, but there are six that are super clear in Mark, and this is the third one of them that's super clear where he's interrupting the story with a second story that fits in, but it helps us understand what he's going to. So with this, where we're reading about this fig tree, well, we're going to be able to get some examples from here in the middle where he goes to the temple to help us better understand what is he trying to say and do with this fig tree. So let's just keep that in mind as we continue to go through this, that what's about to happen here in the middle, while yes, it fits in chronologically, it also is put in here by Mark because it helps us understand what's happening with the fig tree. So let's carry on with verse 15 through 19. And they came to Jerusalem, And he entered the temple and he began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and of the seats of those who sold pigeons. Okay, well, the first thing that I want to let you know is, hey, this is the second, explicit messianic thing that Jesus has done this week. The first was his entry, and now he has this moment. I want to turn back real briefly for you to Malachi, or sometimes fun to say Malachi, the Italian prophet. I'm glad that I got to share that joke with more than the four people who were here the last time. So Malachi verse 3, or Malachi chapter 3, verses 1 through 3. Say this, "Behold, I send my messenger," that's John the Baptist, "and he will prepare the way before me. And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, and the messenger of his covenant in whom you delight, behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts. But who can endure the day of his coming? Who can stand when he appears? For he is like a refiner's file, like fuller's soap. He will sit and refine and purify of silver, and he will purify the sons of Levi and refine them like gold and silver. And they will bring their offerings in righteousness to the Lord." So the key here is that the Lord is coming. He will come to his temple and he will purify. Well, here, that's what we're seeing. That he's coming to his temple and is purifying. Let me help understand a little bit better about what's going on as we're reading this. Set up in the court of the Gentiles, the very first place into the temple was everything that we're about to read about. So if we can think back to what we might know about the temple in Jerusalem, at the very center is the Holy of Holies, where only the high priest would enter on Yom Kippur to offer the atonement for all of the nation. Then you have the court of the Levites, and then the men, and then the women, but then the Gentiles on the very outside place. And that's where the Gentiles could come to rightly worship Yahweh. That's their place. Except one problem. Now, that's not reserved for their worship anymore. All of a sudden, what it is it's become this grand bazaar, this grand market out there. And so what we're reading about here, I'll reread 15 for us here in Mark. It says that there were some who sold and bought in the temple, and he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. So here's what's going on. The first thing, the money changers, is this. If you were a Jewish person coming in for the Passover, like what's happening right now where Jesus is, and you lived all the way over in Greece somewhere, you didn't have the local currency of the Jewish people. And they required you to pay the temple tax in the local currency. So you brought whatever money that you had, you'd get to the temple, and you would exchange what you had for the local currency. Now, one might think that, you know, this is the house of the Lord, and we're here to help you offer right worship. And so, free exchange. You give me your local currency, we give you no cost, we just exchange so you can rightfully offer that local currency to the Lord and pay your temple tax. That's not what's happening. They're charging 25, 30, 40%. So that when you come and say, hey, here's my nickel, they'll say, great, if you want a nickel's worth in a shekel, I need $5, actually. They're just using this as a place to be a den of robbers, to steal from those who are coming. But it gets worse. Because if you were traveling to Jerusalem for the Passover and you were going to be bringing an offering, you had two choices. Let's say three choices, two and a half maybe. You could bring an animal from wherever you were all the way to Jerusalem. An animal that was already kosher and that you kept kosher the whole way there. That's going to be pretty difficult. And if you get there, the priest still has to check your animal and say, yes, this is right for worship. You know what they could just do? Even if you had kept it kosher the whole way? Nah, we don't think so. You're going to have to buy one from us. And guess what? Marked up 200%. Good luck. Or even worse, because it says a dove, the poor didn't have to bring a lamb or a sheep. They could only offer a dove. And they were even doing the same thing with that. Now, good news, you don't have to carry it the whole way. We're selling them here for you. Oh yeah, but remember, it's still marked up 200%. So enjoy that. Again, if you're coming and that dove, which would normally cost a nickel for you, $5, please. Oh, you're poor and you don't have $5? Guess you can't rightly offer your sacrifice to God then. So when Jesus comes into his temple, and this is what he's seeing, he's rightfully upset. There's one more thing that they're even doing that we're going to read about in 16. In 16, he says, and he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. So if you are in the city of Jerusalem and you're headed out of Jerusalem, the absolute fastest way would be to cut through the court of the Gentiles, to come in from one of the gates in the city, to go through the east gate and on right out the city up to the Mount of Olives. That's the fastest way to go. Otherwise, you're going to have to do some trekking through the city. But this is a shortcut. So some people were just walking through on their own, but many caravans would come rolling through here for trade. This got so gross that even not just Jesus, but the Jewish people before the destruction of their temple outlawed this because it had gotten so obscene. So that's the scene that Jesus is walking into. In verse 17, it says, and he was teaching them and saying to them, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for the nations, but you have made it a den of robbers. So that is it not written. That's the red warning bells. We are quoting the Old Testament. Every time he says that, he's quoting the Old Testament. He doesn't quote the Old Testament ever without saying that. So, warning sign, we're quoting something right now. And what he quotes first is Isaiah 56, 7. What he quotes second, where he says, my house has become a den of robbers, is Jeremiah 7, 11. And we won't go and read them because we just got the quotes for them. But he says, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations. Where did I say they were set up? In the court of the Gentiles. So if all of this nonsense is going on, and I'm a Gentile person who has been converted and I love Yahweh and I want to worship him at his temple, I can't go any further. I'm not allowed. Even the Jewish women can enter in further into the temple than I can. This is the only place for me. Is this a place of worship anymore? No. And yet Jesus says, even back as far as Isaiah, that my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations. So when he walks in and sees this, how disgusting. Now, it goes worse. He says, but it has become a den of thieves. This isn't just condemnation on the people who are doing these things, the money traders and the animal sellers. Even worse, this is condemnation on the priests because they're the ones who have allowed all of this. They are the ones who have allowed this place to become a den of thieves. What do thieves do? They steal. Are we shocked by that? No. But shouldn't the guardians of the house of God be the ones to be able to say, hey, thieves, you don't belong here in this way to thieve from our people? Should they not be the one protecting those coming for good worship? And yet they're doing the opposite. They're extorting for them, taking more and more for themselves. How gross. I think to Matthew 7, to what Jesus had already taught. And it connects us with the beginning of our sandwich. In Matthew 7, starting in verse 17, he says, so every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus you will recognize them by their fruits. So when Jesus first sees a fig tree with no good fruit, he curses it. And now he's coming into the temple, and what fruit is he seeing? Just poisoned, wicked fruit. And he condemns it. He drives them out. What's their reaction to this? Do they hear the scriptures? Do they hear the conviction from Jesus and say, wow, Jesus, you're right. We ought to have been giving the Gentiles a place to worship. We ought to have been giving all people a proper way to worship God without trying to extort more money from them. Our bad, we're going to change. We're going to repent. Nah, that's not the response. In 18, it says, and the chief priests and the scribes heard it and were seeking a way to destroy him. For they feared him because all the crowd was astonished at his teaching. So rather than hear this and be convicted and say, no, you're right, our desire is to properly worship God and to follow in his word. No, they just get angry and start coming up with a plot to kill him. They fear him. They don't fear him because of the condemnation in which he will bring, the judgment in which he will bring for the wicked, and the salvation in which he will bring for his people. That's not why they fear him. They fear him because they're losing their worldly influence. That the people are amazed at his teaching. He stands in their temple, so they think, and commands their people, so they think, and they're listening. Their fear is that all people are going to end up following him. A good fear to have. Because they will. Here's what 1 Peter says. And it's the conviction that we ought to hold too. In 1 Peter 4:17, it says, "For it is time for judgment to begin at the household of God. And if it begins with us, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God?" So Peter makes it clear, where is judgment going to start? Here first. The ones who know and who follow his way, and it's no different for them. So if judgment first comes upon those who know and who follow him, we all ought to consider that and recognize how much more for the ones who aren't protected by his grace. The judgment has started in the house of the Lord against those who are actively working to twist it. The judgment starts against those who are actively trying to pull people away. We've seen already how Jesus has come to judge these false shepherds, how that was prophesied earlier in the Old Testament, that he is our good shepherd who will lead us into proper worship, into green pastures, beside still waters, and not these. So now we're going to pick back up with the fig tree. We've had this first explanation of it happening. Then we break in the middle to see this cleansing of the temple, and we see how they parallel. And now we'll resume back with the fig tree. So in verse 20 it says, "As they passed by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered away to its roots. And Peter remembered and said, 'Rabbi, look, the fig tree that you cursed has withered.'" All the way to its roots, totally washed, totally wiped out. Israel gets described all over the New Testament under this analogy of the fig tree. But just to use one place, I'll read it real quickly for us. In Hosea 9, verse 10, it says, "Like grapes in the wilderness, I found Israel. Like the first fruit on the fig tree in its first season, I saw your fathers. But they came to Baal Peor and consecrated themselves to the thing of shame. And they became detestable like the thing they loved." So this imagery that Mark is using of Israel and its temple and its system that it had, using it as the fig tree, this analogy is not even new just for Jesus here in the gospel. It's not even just new for Jesus in the gospel, because we could go look in the other gospels and see where he's already done this previously. We're watching a parable be lived out that he's already taught. In Luke 13, in verse 6 through 9, he tells this parable. Again, this is before his entry into Jerusalem this last week. It says, Luke 13, verse 6. "And he told this parable. A man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard, and he came seeking fruit on it and found none. And he said to the vine dresser, 'Look, for 3 years now I have come seeking fruit on this fig tree, and I find none. Cut it down. Why should it use up the ground?' And he answered him, 'Sir, let it alone this year also until I dig around it and put on manure. Then if it should bear fruit next year, well and good. But if not, you can cut it down.'" We're watching this be played out. This tree that for 3 years, wait, how long was Jesus on earth in his active ministry? Oh yeah, for 3 years. How long had he been looking for fig fruit and found none in this system? It's time to cut it down to its roots. But here's Jesus' response to what Peter has to say. It's not, "Yep, I did that. You all better run, because I'll curse you too." That's not what he says. He says this, and this is where it turns from our warning to our hope. He says, "Have faith in God." He says, "Have faith in God. Truly, I say to you, Whoever says to this mountain, be taken up and thrown into the sea, and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that he says will come to pass, it will be done for him. Instead of warning them and saying, yep, you're next, he says, have faith in God. That's the response. Have faith in God. It's not complex. It's not easy either, but it's not complex. Have faith in God completely. Remember what we talked about, that to go from Bethany into Jerusalem requires you to pass the Mount of Olives. So when he says this mount, he is standing there. He's standing on that mountain and saying that even this mountain can be thrown into the sea. Well, if we're going to say the Dead Sea is the sea he means, that's 13 miles. If we mean the Mediterranean Sea, that's 33 miles to the nearest coast. Don't know about you. I haven't seen mountains move that many miles in my life. So to have the kind of faith that would believe that this mountain would stand up and cast itself into the sea, that is a deep faith. And yet, wouldn't it also be a deep faith that would say that you could walk up to a fig tree and in 12, 24 hours see it completely withered just by saying, may no one ever eat fruit from you again? I'll go with you. If you want to find an orchard, we can stand by every tree and say that and then come back the next day. I've got a feeling none of them are going to be withered to their roots. So when Jesus does this, and when they see it, what's the call? To have great faith. And then he brings up prayer. And that's where he'll sit for the rest of this time, is kind of in this mindset of prayer and faith. And what is faith but us coming to the Lord? Or what is prayer but us coming to the Lord in faith? To come before him and say, this is beyond me, but I trust you. I trust that you will do what you need. This is what I am asking and bringing to you. I'm bringing the situation to you. And I know that I may not see the end goal, but you are working for my good. That you are working for my best intention. That you are bringing it for me. And I may not be for a long time. Noah was building a boat for 8 years. Why? He must have thought many times in the middle of that, but yet he had great faith that the Lord had a reason for this, that he and his family would labor over this boat for that long. And it falls through. It happens. It comes through for him. And so for us, when he calls us at the end of this, when he says, have great faith, that can apply for us everywhere. That can apply for us in any situation, that rather than live life like this, like they were, to bear no good fruit, we could look at ourselves and understand, boy, I wasn't bearing much good fruit. Actually, none. I was dead. I was that dead tree. And yet I had faith that when I would come to him and ask for him to change me, change who I am in my very soul, to be brought into death with him and be brought into new life with him, that I would bear fruit. Fruit from him, that he would be the soil in which my roots are potted. That it would be from him that I draw my strength. It would be from him that I grow into what he has for me. That it would be from him and his goodness that I would be able to soak up and that fruit would come out of me. That I am called to be one who abides in him like roots are in the ground. Roots don't pick up. They stay deep in that soil. They grow deeper in that soil and they pull more from that soil so they might grow bigger and stronger. And that's what we're called to do. A deep, true faith. It's hard. Let's not pretend it isn't. Let's not pretend that it is easy to look at a mountain and say, you'll move. And have absolute faith that if God so wills it, that it will be. Without hesitation. That's not easy. Let's not pretend that it is. But equally, we don't have to do it out of ourselves. Ephesians tells us that that faith is a gift. We hear over and over how that faith is being strengthened by him. That he is the one who is doing this for us, that we ought to just continue every day to be crucified with him, and that we find it in him. All we have to do is wake up and say, Jesus, I choose you today, and live in that, and let him do the rest. keep walking forward. To quote a movie, just keep swimming. Just keep headed in the direction. I don't know what's on the other side. I've forgotten already. Just keep swimming. And just keep heading in that direction. As we kind of review what we've looked at today, we can see in the text that Jesus is bringing this curse and this warning, this judgment against those who have turned his house into what it never was supposed to be. And then we see that he turns this not just to a warning to the apostles, but a hope for the apostles. Trust God. Have great faith. He ends with verse 25. He says, "And whenever you stand praying, forgive. If you have anything against anyone, so that your Father who is also in heaven may forgive you in your trespasses." So not only to come in faith, we come in humility. Willing to be asking for forgiveness. Willing to make right with our brothers and sisters. It's this humble faith that we're called to. It's this humble faith that saves us. It's not one system of religion, even ours. It's not a denomination that saves. It's absolute faith in what Jesus has done for us, in who he says he is, and what he's done. It is this deep-seated, deep-moving faith. Again, not one that we have to somehow come up with out of our own strength. One that we just have to continue to pursue him for, and that he will continue to supply. It gets easier and easier the more we do it. We see his goodness more and more. We trust his promises more and more. We can look at that and know if we are a believer already, what great hope we have that he has already heard us. He's already been moving in our life. That this great miracle of the Holy Spirit coming upon us and changing our life has already happened. And we don't have to look for anything more than him. That we have absolute, absolute joy in him. If Christ isn't enough for us, what would be? The good thing is he is enough for us. So we don't have to look for anything more. Just give him all of our trust, all of our faith, and pursue him fully. And know that, yeah, we were the fig tree that had green leaves, and someone would come up and find no fruit. But he has brought abundant fruit upon us. And let us spread that fruit. What good is a tree full of fruit if no one eats of it? And equally, let us know this, that if we haven't come to him, that's the offer to all of us. If you are still drawing breath on this life, then you are still able to turn to God and find forgiveness and find new life in him. That again, all of us were that. All of us had sinned. All of us had committed acts of sin against God and against others. And for that, we all were condemned. We all were the tree that was cursed. And that we would have to our roots withering and bearing no fruit. Yet in him, we find that life. That we can turn to him, trust him, declare that he is Lord. Put our trust in him, as we've been saying. And then that miracle happens. That we are reborn in the Spirit. That we are brought into new life. That we become part of his body. We can join a local body to be brought in together and to be brought along and discipled, as he calls us to be. So as we read this passage today, hopefully it's a little bit more clear that Jesus just didn't go up to some tree that didn't have fruit when it wasn't supposed to and just say, "Bah humbug, I'm mad at you, I was hungry." He could have just brought fruit out of the tree if that was the case. No, there's a lesson to be learned here. It should have been showing good fruit to come, and it didn't. The temple should have been a house of worship for all, but it had been turned into a den of thieves, into what it shouldn't have been. So when it bears no fruit, when it bears wicked fruit, what does it need? It needs grace, it needs forgiveness, it needs Jesus. And we have found that as Christians. And that is available to anyone who is not. To become one, to enter into him, and to find that life. Let us pray.